Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a landmark decision protecting LGBTQ plus employees from discrimination on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. The news was gratifying for many in the LGBTQ community, especially following the Trump administration's decision last Friday to roll back Obama-era healthcare protections for transgender people. In the majority opinion, Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, wrote, quote, "The answer is clear. An employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex." Gorsuch was joined by fellow conservative Chief Justice John Roberts and the court's four progressive justices, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer. For more on what this decision means for the LGBTQ plus community, we're joined now by Catherine Franke, professor at Columbia Law School and director of Columbia Law School's Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
It's my great pleasure.
Also with us is Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Dahlia, the nuts and bolts of this decision, it protects LGBTQ employees from what exactly?
Well, it protects them under the plain language of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 from discrimination, quote, because of sex. And the other groups that had been protected were folks who were discriminated against on the basis of race, religion, national origin, and sex. Now there's no longer any question that if you are discriminated, in this case it was employment discrimination, but presumably it sprawls out to other forms of discrimination, if sex was the basis of that discrimination, then now you are swept in if you are gay or transgender. And it really was, I think, an astonishing decision insofar as there's just not any question that that is now the fact.
Catherine, there were three cases and people who were at the center of this decision. Two of them have passed away since before the decision was made. Can you remind us who Amy Stevens and Donald Zarda were?
Well, Amy Stevens was an employee at a funeral home who, when she began her work with that funeral home, she presented as male. And then during the time that she worked there, she transitioned and showed up for work one day and said, "I am now a woman and I will be coming to work as a woman and want to be regarded as a woman by my employer and by the people who were the customers of that funeral home." And her employer fired her because she was transgender. And, you know, particularly during this period of COVID, where we know people who work in funeral homes are just doing an incredible service for our country, for people we love. It's a very tough time for all of us. The kind of inhumanity of the ownership of this funeral home to fire Amy Stevens, who was doing this incredible work, was crushing for so many people. And of course, she passed away several months ago before she could know that she had won her case. Being a plaintiff in a case like this is a real burden. You know, the kind of public attention you get, personal attacks from people who are opposing transgender rights are just unrelenting. And so she's a real hero in so many ways, standing up for transgender people, for the rights of transgender people, and then winning this case. And we just all hope she's looking down and smiling in this happy moment.
Dahlia, when we talk about these protections, often they sound, you know, very good on paper. I'm wondering if you can tell us exactly how these protections will now be applied in the workplace. Because one of the most difficult things when it comes to cases involving discrimination is really proving said discrimination or proving intent of that discrimination. So explain to us how this is going to be applied.
That's right. And I think it's important also to point out that not every workplace is subject to Title VII protections. It depends on the number of people that you employ. And so Catherine may know better than I, the statistic that I've been hearing is there are still 18% of LGBTQ workers who would not be covered because they just work for very small businesses that are not subject to Title VII. But you're exactly right. This is not by any means the end of the story. It simply means that you can make a claim now if you are fired for being gay or for gender identity. Then you can make a claim that the basis of the firing was discrimination. You still have to prove it, as you said. You have to prove, still meet a fairly high bar to say, for instance, that the reason for the firing wasn't pretextual. So you're quite right. You still have to make a case, and by no means does that mean that everyone will prevail. But I do think it's important, and folks forget this, that over half the states did not have state civil rights protections. So if you were fired explicitly for being gay in most of the states, you had no recourse. And so at minimum, I think we can say at least now we know that the playing field all around the country in every state is equal. And while, again, it's not a slam dunk, you'll prevail in litigation, at least you do have this protection that didn't exist just this time yesterday.
Catherine, the decision was 6-3, as we mentioned at the top of the segment. Justice Neil Gorsuch, who is a Trump appointee, wrote the majority opinion. Many are saying that that was notable. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and the fact that Chief Justice John Roberts also weighed in on this.
Well, most of us who are court watchers in this area were expecting us to lose this case, and that the argument that Justice Alito makes in his dissent that the issue should be resolved by Congress, that they should amend Title VII and include sexual orientation and gender identity protections. We expected that that would be where the court would go in its majority opinion. But that didn't happen. And not only did we get six votes, but Neil Gorsuch, a conservative, widely regarded conservative, wrote the opinion. Now, the fact that Justice Roberts also joined the majority meant that he could assign the opinion to Justice Gorsuch, whereas otherwise someone like Justice Ginsburg might have written the opinion, and we would have gotten a very different reasoning in the case had Justice Ginsburg written the opinion as opposed to Justice Gorsuch. And I'll just note that while it's fantastic that we won, and we clearly won in this case, the opinion reads very, it's kind of a mechanical reasoning. It's very sort of logical, almost machine-like reasoning about how to interpret the word sex in this kind of context. What we don't see in the opinion is sort of soaring, impassioned language about why we have a tradition of protecting equality in the workplace, why this is a fundamental American value, why we passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and why these sorts of workplace protections are so important. And what concerns me about it, as we think down the road, and there will be religious objectors to complying with this rule, is that on the one hand, when the court writes about religious liberty, it does so with an impassioned, heartfelt commitment to religious liberty as a fundamental American value. And on the other hand, we have this kind of mechanical reasoning about Title VII and workplace equality. And when those two values face off, I'm a little concerned about not having language we can pull from this decision to say the state has a compelling interest in protecting workplace equality that can compete with the state's compelling interest in protecting religious liberty.
Catherine, we're going to talk about more about the Trump administration's decision to roll back protections for transgender people in our segment coming up. But I'm just curious whether or not this decision by the Supreme Court sort of nullifies the Trump decision on transgender health care protections, or are they still two separate things?
Well, yes and yes. This was specifically a case about workplace discrimination, interpreting just one particular statute, Title VII. But the court's reasoning, I think, was broad enough that any good advocate is going to argue that wherever sex-based discrimination protections are in place, either on the federal level or on the local level, they should be interpreted to include sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. And any government actor who's going to deny that is going to have a very steep hill to climb in order to persist in a narrow reading of what sex-based discrimination protections mean.
Dahlia, one of the interesting things, and I say interesting in air quotes here, about the current administration has been how successful the current administration has been in terms of judge placements in lower courts. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on what this decision could mean for lower courts, which have essentially been dramatically reshaped by the Trump administration.
It is the question. I think that we often forget that while we focus all our attention on the U.S. Supreme Court, they hear a tiny fraction of the cases that are appealed up, and that the vast, vast majority of litigation in this country in federal courts gets resolved at the federal circuit courts, the appellate courts, that you're quite right. Trump has utterly transformed. I think he's at 200 judges, at least at the appellate level, one in four judges is now a Donald Trump appointee. And I think you're also right to point out that an awful lot of these judges are very young. They're going to be sitting for a long time. And actually, some of these religious liberty cases are where they made their bones as young lawyers. An awful lot of them fought very hard against reproductive justice and marriage equality. That's one of their single common traits. Now, at the same time, they're bound by the Supreme Court ruling. They can't make it go away. But I think you're going to see real pushback and the kind of parsing that Catherine flicks at when she says it's not soaring languages, it's not sweeping protections. So I think you will see lower courts try to, if not overtly nullify this ruling, certainly cabinet, say, as little as possible to limit it to employment and to push back on the theory that at some point they can seat someone else on the Supreme Court and make this go away.
This is a topic that we will be watching for quite some time. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. And Catherine Franke is a professor at Columbia Law School and the director of the Columbia Law School Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Of course.
Yesterday's Supreme Court ruling cemented protections against workplace discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. But the ruling also comes days after the Trump administration approved another rule rolling back Obama-era health protections for trans people. And that comes at a moment when organizers are drawing attention to the disproportionate rates of violence faced by transgender women of color. Here's activist Raquel Willis speaking at a rally in Brooklyn on Sunday.
You know, I might get in some trouble for saying this. And yes, the legislation matters, but white queer folk get to worry about legislation while black queer folk is worrying about our lives.
Joining me now to talk about the transgender rights movement and where it goes from here is Shelby Chestnut, Director of Policy and Programs at the Transgender Law Center. Shelby, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And just so our listeners are aware, the Transgender Law Center is the organization that filed a brief in the Supreme Court case in support of Amy Stevens. Shelby, how much does the SCOTUS decision shift the legal landscape for transgender rights in the United States?
I mean, yesterday's opinion was welcome news and a historic victory for LGBT people, and I think for trans people, a victory that we didn't see necessarily coming in the ways that we thought it would. But I also think if we're going to make this historic victory meaningful, to Raquel's point, we need to lift up the leadership of Black trans people and ensure that they stay alive.
So there is an exemption for Title VII for religious organizations in this ruling. How much do you think that is going to complicate workplace protections for transgender people in particular?
I mean, I think what we do need to remember is that the highest court in the country made it clearly that LGBT people are a protected class with employment and covered within sex-based protections to include trans people. So I think they will attempt to roll things back, but I also think that we have sort of legal precedents on our side to continue to fight this.
Last week, as we mentioned, the Trump administration rolled back the Obama-era rule that protected transgender people from discrimination by healthcare providers and insurers. Where does that rule? I mean, we just heard at the previous segment that this could really, the Supreme Court ruling might even trump, no pun intended, that decision to roll back those protections. But where do you see that headed?
Yeah, I think it is like a both and to some extent. And I think that yesterday's opinion made it very clear that transgender people are a protected class and to some extent can and will void Trump's attempt to limit access to health care for transgender people. Obviously, that will need to get seen in courts and debated. And there will be many attempts to limit trans people's access to health care. But given that this ruling is now here, it sets precedent for us to have an argument that actually we're a protected class and you can't continue to gut our rights at every attempt.
You mentioned at the top of this segment, we had a clip from one of the rallies that took place here in New York City to protect Black trans lives. According to the Human Rights Campaign, at least 14 transgender and gender nonconforming people have been killed so far this year. But violence against the transgender community is disproportionately directed at Black transgender women and other transgender women of color. Shelby, how much do legal decisions like this one actually matter to transgender people of color?
I mean, I think they're hugely important. And I think also it points to the disparities that trans people of color, specifically Black trans women, face around the country, especially regions like the South and the Midwest, where there's limited access to rights and resources. And, you know, I think what we are clear on is that there's been an epidemic of violence against Black trans women for many decades, and it's been fought by many people. And now is the moment where we shift our energy to the long legacy of ending that violence against Black trans women and prioritizing the needs of trans people of color across the country. Because we know that legal rights are important, but it's also harm reduction. It's not going to ensure that we have our day-to-day lives protected and that we're not killed in the streets for being who we are.
And does this often, I mean, often hear the conversation in this country is that we don't often see violence as a public health issue. Is that where you stand when it comes to violence against transgender people, particularly Black transgender women? Should this be seen as a public health issue as opposed to an issue of criminality?
I mean, I definitely think it's a public health issue. I mean, there's study after study, especially ones that we've led at the Transgender Law Center through our Positively Trans program, which works with trans people living with HIV. A disproportionate number of folks in that program are Black trans people in the South. And they've unequivocally said that when our basic needs are not met, like access to health care, access to jobs, access to shelter, that we're more susceptible to violence and more likely to be killed. And I think it's a moment where we actually need to shift our focus from just seeking legal protections to naming the problem for what it's been for many years. And everyone should be putting their resources and time and energy into addressing this epidemic of violence.
Shelby, we saw a huge turnout for the rally for Black trans lives here in New York over the weekend. What is it that the LGBTQ movement needs to do better going forward to make sure that some of the policy victories that it is achieving are really inclusive and not just for white LGBTQ people?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I was at the rally in Brooklyn over the weekend and I had never seen anything like that in my many years of organizing and trans rights. So I was heartened to see so many people out in the streets supporting trans rights and really naming that. I think right now is the moment to look around your community and find the Black trans organizers, find the Black trans women leading this work and support their leadership and find those organizations to lift up, to donate to organize with, to ask them what they need in this moment to sort of survive this moment that we're in.
Shelby Chestnut is the Director of Policy and Programs at the Transgender Law Center. Shelby, thanks so much.
Thank you.